Chapter 19. The Recruitment. Ostensibly, Gustav Rakatos was the moving force in this recruitment drama. And certainly, had he not made the first move, nothing further would have happened. But the fact was, he had just walked into a trap that Charlie Wilson had set long before. Wilson, too, was relying on his political instincts. He knew that somewhere in the CIA there had to be people who thought as he did. He had tried to woo the agency with offers of money. When that failed, he had stood on the outside and threatened to lay siege to their fortress if they didn't accept his offer. Avrakatos was the one who took the bait. The result was a mutual recruitment and the birth of a secret partnership that would transform the Afghan war. The way Charlie recalls that first encounter, Avrakatos actually asked for only $40 million, whereupon Wilson responded by upping the amount to $50 million. "That day we recognized that we could be good for each other," says Avrakatos. "I think Charlie realized that I'm loyal and brutally honest, and I knew I could call on him. He would protect me." Initially, Avrakatos took the lead as he began to introduce Wilson to the intricacies of political life inside the CIA. They both understood that the first battle they must fight would be against the CIA's cautious leaders. Together, they worked out a ritual dance that they would refine and put to use with great effect time and again in the coming months. Following Gust's instructions, Wilson telephoned Casey and said he was prepared to give the agency $50 million more for Afghanistan. Could the director use it? Charlie added that he had already taken it upon himself to put this question to Avrakatos. That left Casey with little choice but to check with the actual orchestrator of this charade, Gust Avrakatos, who confirmed that Wilson had called him and that in response to the congressman's demanding questions, he had admitted that the program could use more cash. The director had little choice but to sign off on the offer. With that in place, Wilson set out to work his magic on the Appropriations Committee. "By this time, I had everyone in Congress convinced that the Mujahideen were a cause only slightly below Christianity," Wilson remembers. "Everyone on the subcommittee was enthusiastic. I gave them the sense they could lead the way on a just cause. I told the conservatives it was time we fucked the Russians. Told the liberals it would prove that they were against communism even if they didn't support the Contras." The CIA was in very bad odor in the House that summer. There was some grumbling from the liberals who had just defeated the administration's $19 million request for the Contras. Wilson realized he couldn't just rely on political clout. He would have to sell this one. "So I defended the $50 million in front of the whole committee. We ordered the staff to leave. It was the only time I ever had to do this." Above all, Wilson is a masterful storyteller, and he began by describing the events of Christmas Day 1979, when the great, unconquerable Red Army began airlifting troops into Afghanistan. "But the Russians picked on the wrong guys," he told his colleagues. "Even as we speak, illiterate shepherds and tribesmen are confounding the Soviets. They are making them pay and pay and pay. The money we're talking about represents 0.1% of our appropriations bill, and this 0.1% is the part that could change history. And even if it doesn't," he concluded, looking about the room with unquestioned sincerity, "it is our sacred duty to make valuable the lives that these people are laying down." Wilson directed a final point to the instinctive mistrust of his liberal colleagues for CIA interventions. "The U.S. had nothing whatsoever to do with these people's decision to fight. The Afghans made this decision on Christmas, and they're going to fight to the last, even if they have to fight with stones. But we'll be damned by history if we let them fight with stones." Whatever opposition had existed before vanished by the time of the full committee vote. "I don't remember one nay," says Wilson, who would use variations on this speech at other critical junctures over the coming years when the outcome of a vote was uncertain. When Charlie called Avrakatos the next day, it was to announce that he would soon have the entire $50 million. "We were just gleeful," remembers Wilson. "That $50 million was a direct Avrakatos-Wilson conspiracy. We had made our first move together." The figure grew to $100 million when the Saudis' matching funds came through a few months later, a fact made all the more astonishing because Congress was simultaneously moving to completely close down the Contra War. Bill Casey had no choice now but to take notice. He had just been raked over the coals by Barry Goldwater, the Senate Intelligence Committee chairman, who was furious about the CIA's operation to mine the Nicaraguan harbors. The House, meanwhile, under Tip O'Neill's leadership, had succeeded in banning all military assistance to the Nicaraguan rebels. Casey was perceived by many congressional Democrats to be running an outlaw agency, and when it came to the Contra War, he was prepared to do almost anything to keep it going. Alan Fears, who took over the Central American Task Force after losing out to Avracatos for the Afghan job, recalled to the Wall Street Journal the enormous significance Casey attached to the Contra War. Casey told him, "Alan, you know the Soviet Union is tremendously overextended and they're vulnerable. If America challenges the Soviets at every turn and ultimately defeats them in one place, that will shatter the mythology, and it will all start to unravel. Nicaragua," Casey said, "is that place." The CIA director and Oliver North at the White House were just then starting to plot alternative routes to fund the Contras and bypass congressional restrictions. One can only imagine the director's confusion at Wilson's ability to tap huge sums for the Afghans, while neither his nor President Reagan's direct appeal for Contra support had yielded anything. By most accounts, Casey was repelled by Wilson's carnal lifestyle. Ed Jinowitz, who shares an intense Catholic background with the director, explained that Casey was a prude when it came to lifestyle issues. He was educated by Jesuits and nuns, and the stories about Wilson, the belly dancers, the drugs, the drinking, the constant womanizing, offended him. Avracatos also noted the director's initial disapproval of Wilson's overt hedonism. "This whole thing about cocaine really bothered him. The perception about perverted sex, about drug use, and about being Mr. 5%. Casey just didn't want that black cloud to land on the agency's image." But the director's pet, the Contra War, was now in jeopardy, and Casey was the ultimate pragmatist. In spite of his concerns about Wilson, he decided to try to enlist the congressman to help with the Contras. By that time, Casey had discovered Wilson's role as the great defender of Tacho Somoza, and had deduced that Charlie would want to do his part to punish Somoza's enemies, the Soviet-backed Sandinistas. Adding to the argument was the fact that much of the leadership of the CIA's Contra Army came directly from Somoza's U.S.-trained National Guard. Wilson felt almost triumphant returning to Casey's office, assuming that he would be recognized as the mighty CIA patron he had become. The director, whom he so revered, congratulated him on his extraordinary ability to put through so much money for the Afghans. "You know, the entire administration is going through unmitigated hell trying to get a few million for the Contras, who are next door to us, and you've just increased the Afghan program by $90 million. I don't understand this." Wilson was elated by the director's praise until he realized the real reason Casey had summoned him. Could Wilson see a way of sharing just 10% of the Afghan appropriation with the Contras? The director insisted it would make all the difference. "We could win the war in 6 months." It was no small request. The president desperately wanted to keep the Nicaraguan resistance alive, and the director was asking the patriotic Texas congressman to do his part. "I'd like nothing more than to do that, but Tip wouldn't like it," Wilson told the director, referring to Speaker Tip O'Neill. He added that he would only destroy his ability to work for the Afghans if he set out to champion the Contras. When Casey asked if he wouldn't at least try, Wilson quite bluntly explained that the Contra War was a lost cause. Clearly, the director didn't understand what Nicaragua had come to mean to liberals in America. Influential leaders in every city in the country were agitated about the agency's operations. Hundreds of Americans were actually working for the Sandinista government. Every Friday afternoon, they would gather in front of the U.S. Embassy to protest the war, often joined by many more Americans visiting Nicaragua. O'Neill's niece was in Managua, and housewives and ministers from Witness for Peace were going up to the border to symbolically interpose themselves between the Contra Army and the Sandinistas. Reporters were flying in and out of the country filing dispatches about the agency's hopelessly public covert operation. All that was tame, Wilson told Casey, compared to the white passion that he was seeing close up from his Democratic colleagues. Even his close friend, level-headed Majority Leader Jim Wright, acted as if getting the CIA out of Nicaragua was his life's crusade. The most powerful and intractable foe, however, was still the Speaker, and nothing anyone said was going to change his mind. What Wilson didn't tell the director that day, because it would have enraged Casey, was that he had already cut a deal with O'Neill, an implicit quid pro quo arrangement in which he'd agreed, in effect, to sell out the Contras in exchange for leading the House when it came to funding the Afghan War. "I can tell you that we would not have been involved in Afghanistan had it not been for Charlie," says Tony Coelho, the Democratic whip at the House. "Most members didn't know where Afghanistan was, and the majority didn't care." Coelho, one of the true scholars of power in the House, explained why the arrangement was necessary. "Nicaragua was a bitter, bitter, vicious fight with state, CIA, the military, and the White House against us. If Charlie had gotten caught up in any of those battles, he wouldn't have gotten anywhere." It was not the first time Wilson cut a private deal with the Speaker. O'Neill had tapped him during the Abscam scandals on behalf of his great friend, Representative John Murtha. "He would do things like this for O'Neill," explains Coelho, "and the leadership learned that it could count on him." Wilson's conservative anti-communist colleagues had repeatedly tried to get him to join their contra-crusade, but he'd always stayed out. O'Neill didn't expect him to vote with a Democratic majority, but the understanding was that he would not use his influence or energies to work against them. Deep into the scotch one night, Wilson recalled the bargain with genuine remorse. "Even though I knew they were a lost cause, I'll always have to live with the fact that I sold out the Contras." But for the Afghans, the rewards that came from this Contra betrayal were extraordinary. In retirement, the former Speaker was surprisingly candid in describing his machinations with Wilson. "I knew that Charlie was doing undercover work with the Defense Department and the CIA and everyone else, but we blinked while he was doing it. I figured Charlie was on the right side, and I knew that no American soldiers were going to be involved. I used to tell him, 'I don't want to know this, Charlie, you just go ahead.'